Hi everyone, my name is Dan Witt. I am the chair and professor of pharmacotherapy at the University of Utah College of Pharmacy. And I would like to welcome you today to this activity for managing cardiovascular disease. We'll be discussing today specifically venous thromboembolic pathology and direct oral anticoagulant pharmacokinetic considerations in patients with obesity. So let's begin. I don't have any disclosures that are relevant to the content of this particular activity. Our learning objectives today are to help you understand better the pathophysiologic mechanisms that underlie the risk of venous thromboembolism that is associated with obesity. We also would like to delve into any pharmacokinetic changes that occur with obesity that might influence the absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion of direct oral anticoagulants. I'd like to start off with a patient case to frame what we're going to be talking about in today's activity. So we've got a 56-year-old male patient who comes in complaining of left lower leg swelling, and this has been going on for about a week. He hasn't had any traumatic episodes. He does have a remote history of a deep vein thrombosis that occurred about 13 years ago, but no new risk factors. And currently right now, he's pretty asymptomatic other than the complaints in his lower leg. He's not having any chest pain or shortness of breath. You can see his vital signs there. And most importantly, I think, is that his blood pressure is a little elevated, but not too far out of line. And his respiration rate is good, and also he's got a good O2 sat, 97%. But importantly, when we weigh this patient, we see that his weight is quite high, 380 pounds, and that calculates out for his height to a BMI of 49. The other thing is that he had a compression ultrasound that revealed that he currently has an acute deep vein thrombosis in his left common femoral vein. So our question then is, what pathophysiologic mechanisms relating to this patient's obesity may have contributed to an increased risk for venous thromboembolism? And your choices are A, chronic low-grade inflammation, B, platelet activation, C, vascular endothelial dysfunction, or D, all of the above might factor in. So go ahead and vote now. Before we dig into the rest of this content, I think it's important for us to just have a very brief overview of the hemostasis process. So this is what our bodies have available when we develop bleeding in order to form a blood clot that will then prevent that bleeding from becoming severe and then allow healing to occur. And so you've got a cross-sectional view here of a blood vessel, and you can see that there's been some disruption to the endothelial cell lining that lines the walls of the blood vessel, and that's exposed the subendothelial spaces beneath that layer. This enables circulating components of the blood like platelets, red blood cells, clotting factors to come in contact with these subendothelial layers. And so some key players are von Willebrand factor, you can see on the top left, collagen, and these interact with receptors on the platelets to cause those platelets to then become active and begin to stick together or to aggregate. You can see that blood clotting factors also are exposed to something called tissue factor that is exposed in the subendothelial space. This activates the clotting factor process to generate thrombin. And there's also some cross-activation that goes back and forth between thrombin generation and platelet activation. And the net result here is that we start to then convert fibrinogen into strands of fibrin, which are sticky spiderweb-like fragments that then begin to form a mesh that traps platelets and red blood cells and white blood cells there to form a stable plug that then prevents the bleeding from occurring. You can imagine that if you had a car that only had a gas pedal, it would be very hard to control that car, and you would be likely to get out of control. And the same thing is true for the blood clotting process. In addition to those factors that favor thrombosis, which we've just reviewed and are summarized on the left hand of this diagram here, we've also got some factors that inhibit thrombosis or modulate that process to keep it from getting out of control. And an important thing that I want to point out is that the healthy endothelium that is next to where the clot is forming is very important in this process. And it has substances available, things like antithrombin, tissue factor pathway inhibitor, thrombomodulin, and all of these things then contribute to a braking mechanism on the formation of clotting that keeps that process hopefully highly contained to where the site of injury is and does not start a general thrombosis that could then cause blood flow blockage and ischemia, which would be problematic. And then at the far right hand of this diagram, you can see that healthy endothelium also secretes tissue plasminogen activator, which is then initiates the fibrinolytic process, and we'll say a little bit more about that at a later slide, but that helps to dissolve the blood clot when it's no longer needed. So now let's focus in on why obesity is a risk factor for the development of venous thromboembolism, or blood clots that form in the deep veins of the venous circulation. At a high level, obesity produces a very low-grade chronic inflammatory state, and I'll explain in the next slides why that is important. And that state of inflammation then is associated with endothelial damage and dysfunction, platelets that are quote-unquote angrier or more likely to aggregate together and produce thrombosis, enhanced coagulability, so the clotting factor cascade gets ramped up, and then also impairs the ability of the body to break down any clot that's formed. And all of these things then translate together into heightened risk for venous thromboembolism in patients that have obesity. In this diagram, you can see that compared to a normal weight individual, there is just much more inflammatory cell activity just in volume and also in the types of inflammatory cells that are associated with the condition of obesity. Those inflammatory cells then can release different types of cytokines and other inflammatory modulators that translate then into several different things. And this is a review somewhat to the slide that we just went over, but endothelial dysfunction is one of those things. Differences in platelet reactivity, a heightened sense, as I said before, angrier platelets that are more likely to aggregate together, increased activity of the thrombosis cascade or clotting factors that results in hypercoagulability, and then, as I mentioned before, decreased fibrinolysis, so any clot that is formed doesn't break down as rapidly. And all of those then translate into a prothrombotic state that favors the formation of blood clots. I'm going to next go over in just briefly each one of these four different factors that increase clotting risk in venous thromboembolism. Let's focus in on endothelial dysfunction. On the left side of this diagram, you can see that healthy endothelium plays an important role, and blood flowing through the veins of the lower extremity, there are these one-way valves that help move blood back towards the right side of the heart. And so as blood flows through those, they then close, and you get some sweeping out and clearing out of any blood that might pool in the valve cusps. And healthy endothelium is really important in that process. In the chronic inflammatory state that is associated with obesity, we get prothrombotic endothelial cell type phenotypes that have many characteristics then that increase the risk of blood clot formation. And you can see that depicted in the middle right of the slide. And this is important because as blood clots can form in these valve cusps, it causes the valves to then not function as proper, and that further increases the risk for blood clotting. Let's focus in on platelet hyperreactivity. Three key areas that I want to highlight with this slide is we've talked about the inflammation that occurs with obesity, but that causes alterations in the secretion of different adipokines, namely increase in leptin secretion. And you can see there that that causes interaction with different receptors on the platelet surface that increase the activation of platelets and make them more likely then to participate in blood clot formation. On the right top, you can see the insulin resistance. Normally, insulin actually has some properties that decrease the reactivity of platelets. And with obesity and the state of insulin resistance that can be associated with that condition, that removes this blocking mechanism, and that also results in platelet activation. And then the formation of reactive oxygen species can also cause interactions through the arachidonic acid cascade with various receptors on the platelet. All of these things translating into platelets that are more likely to aggregate together and recruit other platelets to get involved with the clot formation process. In terms of hypercoagulability, there are several different molecules within the coagulation cascade that are increased or altered in obesity. An important one is tissue factor. Tissue factor can be considered the fuse that really lights the coagulation cascade and gets it going. And so increased tissue factor concentrations can also increase the potential for clot formation. Fibrinogen is the precursor of those fibrin strands that are used to form the stable clot. And so if there's more fibrinogen around, there's more potential for fibrin to be formed. Von Willebrand factor is what attracts the platelets. And so that is another factor that increases platelet activity. And then factor 7 and factor 8 are important components of the clotting factor cascade that get increased, thus increasing the potential that we're going to get fibrin clot formation and increased risk for pathologic clot in the lower extremities. This slide gives a depiction of the fibrinolytic process. So as we discussed before, healthy endothelium releases tissue plasminogen activator, or TPA, on this slide. It converts plasminogen into plasmin, and plasmin is what helps to break down those fibrin strands and help dissolve the blood clot. Plasminogen activator inhibitor, depicted in the bottom left of this diagram in the brown, PAI, that is an important inhibitor of tissue plasminogen activator. And in obesity, we get a dramatic upregulation of the activity of plasminogen activator inhibitor, which then decreases the action of TPA, thus making it more difficult for a clot that is formed to break down. And the net result of that is just increased clot burden and greater potential for clot formation. A really helpful construct to think about the increased risk for blood clotting is something called Virchow's triad. And what this hypothesizes is that there's sort of three sides of a triangle here: hypercoagulability of blood, stasis of blood, and then damage to blood vessel walls. And if any of those components, and especially if more than one of those components, are involved, that increases the risk for pathologic blood clot formation. So you can see that with obesity, we hit on almost all of those elements of Virchow's triad. We've just been over in pretty good detail the top one there, the hypercoagulability, all the different derangements that we just talked about. And down at the bottom, blood vessel wall damage as well. That is something that is associated with obesity and the inflammation that goes on during that condition. And then in terms of stasis of blood, although this is a little less well characterized than some of the other ones, it could be that the blood is more static because of the larger vein size that is associated with obese individuals. Could be that there's impaired function of those venous valves, as was demonstrated in the slide that we looked at just a moment ago. And there could be increased pressure within the veins, making it harder for the blood to get back up towards the heart. And when that blood pools in the lower extremities, that increases the risk for blood clot formation. So it's important to realize that nearly all of the elements of Virchow's triad are impaired in obesity. So this translates to an almost 2- to 6-fold increase in risk for venous thromboembolism in individuals with obesity. And that's important because that combines with other risk factors, like if an individual is hospitalized, patients who are pregnant, patients who are taking combined estrogen, progestin, hormonal contraceptives, those who are immobile for whatever reason, a plaster cast, hospitalization, those types of things. And there are many other types of risk factors. All of these things combine together with risk factors to increase the risk for venous thromboembolism in patients with obesity. And I think it's important for us to recognize that many of these obesity-related changes can be reversible with weight loss. And that's something that I think can be an important educational point as we're working with our patients who've suffered venous thromboembolism if obesity is among their risk factors. Now I want to shift gears just a little bit and talk about the impact that obesity might have on the pharmacokinetics of direct oral anticoagulants. Direct oral anticoagulants are newer drugs. The standard drug was warfarin and different types of heparin. But these newer drugs, the direct oral anticoagulants, which I'm going to refer to from here on out as DOACs, just so it's a little easier to say. But obesity can have a significant impact on different pharmacokinetic parameters. And what do I mean when I talk about pharmacokinetics? These are things like how drugs are absorbed, distributed throughout the body, metabolized or broken down, and then excreted from the body. So ADME. Now, with the older drugs that we used to use, like warfarin and especially unfractionated heparin, we actually would use a blood test to monitor the effects of these drugs. So when you were given a dose of warfarin, you could tell if you were given the right dose because you would order a blood test and see if it was in the right range. Same thing with heparin. Or with the newer low molecular weight heparins, you would actually then base them on the patient's weight. And so these two things made us a little less leery about using these types of drugs in patients at different weights, and especially those at the extremes of weight, very low weight or very heavy. Along came the fixed dose DOAC drugs, and this sort of threw a little bit of a wrench into the status quo, because now we've got a fixed dose of drug, but potentially differences in the way that these drugs are handled in the body. And that makes them a little bit more clinically challenging to use, or at least we didn't have a lot of information about how these drugs might perform in patients at the extremes of the weight spectrum. Some of the obesity-related changes that we can expect with ADME is absorption doesn't tend to really be affected. With distribution, though, you can imagine that a drug that is lipophilic or that dissolves well in fat, if there's just a greater burden of adipose tissue in an obese individual, it just means that there's more drug that could then disperse into fill up that space, and that might then result in lower levels of the drug actually in the blood. And there can also be some differences in volume of distribution if we adjust things based on weight. But the important thing to remember here is that the volume of distribution is generally going to increase for lipophilic drugs in obese individuals. The clearance of drug from the body, either metabolism in the liver or other types of breakdown of drugs, sometimes increases proportionally with body weight. And an important metabolizing agent for the DOACs is CYP3A4, and that activity might actually decrease. So it's sort of hard to predict what the actual net effect of this is going to be in an obese individual, and I'll go over that in just a second. And then as far as excretion is concerned, either elimination in the urine or in the bile, we can get increases in or decreases in clearance. So we may see prolonged half-lives, or we can actually see decreases in half-lives. Again, the uncertainty of how an individual patient is going to respond to a DOAC with a fixed dose gives us some cause for concern. So in this slide, it's actually focused on both low-weight individuals and obese individuals, but we're going to focus in on the obese individuals. So starting at the left hand of the slide, you can see that in obese individuals, dabigatran, the concentration in the maximum concentration in the plasma is actually decreased in the obese state. Whereas with rivaroxaban, we see the opposite effect. We actually see some increases in the exposure to drug for a patient. And then with apixaban, we see the opposite, again, decreases in some of these pharmacokinetic parameters, indicating that maybe we're not achieving the levels of drugs that we would in a normal weight individual. And with the edoxaban, we just don't have a whole lot of information. The key takeaway point from this slide is that it's hard to know what the net effect is going to be in any individual obese patient, and that's why I think we're a little nervous when we're using a fixed dose of drug. So pharmacokinetic principles would lead us to believe then that in high body weight individuals, probably the profile that we're looking for is a DOAC that has a low volume of distribution, high protein binding, and limited renal elimination. Those things might then confer some favorable properties to help us to conclude that we're not going to see much differences between obese individuals and normal weight individuals. And if you look at the table at the top of the slide there, you can see that apixaban is the drug that has the lowest volume of distribution and renal elimination, whereas rivaroxaban has the highest protein binding. So maybe those are drugs that if we're going to use in obese individuals might have the most favorable pharmacokinetic profile. All right, well, as we begin to wrap up the presentation for today, let's focus in on some unanswered questions. So we've talked about alterations in DOAC pharmacokinetic parameters. The real question is are these associated with different outcomes in obese individuals compared to normal weight individuals? And unfortunately, in the clinical trials for these drugs, there were not many patients at the extremes of body weight, including high weight individuals, that were included. And so we really don't know if we're going to see any differences in the outcomes, although emerging evidence would lead us to believe that there appears to be the not big changes in the outcomes associated with extremes in weight. Now, the prior drugs that we've used historically, warfarin and heparin, are associated with a narrow therapeutic index. And what I mean by that is the difference between a drug that would produce toxicity or increase bleeding risk and the dose of drug that would produce the desired therapeutic effect is small. And so we're sort of used to that paradigm of anticoagulants are associated with a narrow therapeutic index. There's evidence to suggest that with the DOACs, we may not be dealing with a narrow therapeutic index drug. So for instance, we know that from the clinical trials, using a fixed dose of these medications produced similar clinical outcomes, or in some cases, better clinical outcomes than using closely monitored warfarin therapy. So that's one line of evidence to indicate that they may not have the same type of narrow therapeutic index that warfarin does. A second line of evidence is when we initiate therapy for venous thromboembolism treatment with these drugs, we actually start out with much higher doses of the drugs. In the case of apixaban, we actually give double the dose. Now, that just wouldn't happen with warfarin. If you gave double the dose of warfarin to a patient, you would likely very much increase their risk for bleeding. But that doesn't seem to be the case with the DOACs. So that's another line of evidence to suggest a more wide therapeutic index. And then also, as we've treated patients with venous thromboembolic disease, after 3 to 6 months, we can actually half the dose of the DOAC and not seem to really influence how well it does at preventing further risk for blood clotting. So all of these things might indicate that with DOACs, we have a much wider therapeutic index, meaning that some of the changes that we actually observe in the absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion of these drugs with obesity may not translate into meaningful differences in how well they're actually going to perform clinically. And finally, there's a thing known as the obesity paradox. And what that means is that obesity in some subjects with several chronic diseases has actually been associated with decreased mortality. It's unknown why that actually is, but there's some theory behind that. But it also seems to apply to the use of DOACs in obese patients, meaning that we were very worried that we'd see different outcomes with obese patients. But pharmacoepidemiologic data that we've had heretofore is indicating that obese patients might actually do better than patients that are normal weight. So to wrap up, let's go back to our patient case. Remember, we had a 56-year-old man that was presenting with an acute DVT in his left common femoral vein, and he was quite obese. Now that you've gone through this activity, let's ask the same question. What pathophysiologic mechanisms relating to his obesity may have contributed to his increased risk for having this blood clot? Again, selection A is chronic low-grade inflammation. B is platelet activation. C is vascular endothelial dysfunction. Or D is it all of the above? And hopefully through participating in this activity, you're feeling much more confident with your answer. I'd like to thank you for taking the time to participate in this activity today, and I wish you a good day. Thank you.